Now we continue our brief introduction into the religion of Islam. And when we last left off, we had talked about the official writings, the scriptures, of course, the Quran, and the hadith, the traditions about what Muhammad did or said, which become also authoritative for the interpretation of Muslim life and so on. These are the most important of all the writings. There are six books of hadith, and we find that there grew up a number of ways of viewing them. The Qahariites were separatists or purists, and they held that was strictly held to strictly Quranic teaching. And there are several controversies that arose in doctrine, and one of them was, how do we tell who's a true Muslim? Really difficult question to raise, because you can't look into the heart of someone else, but they wanted signs and ways of telling that someone was a genuine believer or not. The Muirites were the people who said only God can tell us who's a true Muslim. Sounds right. Anyway, the other issues have to do with how to decide questions that are not answered in the Quran. And there's grew up a way of procedure for dealing with such questions. And here is what one of the hadith says about this. On being appointed governor of Yemen, Mu'ad was asked by the Holy Prophet as to the rule by which he would abide. And he replied, by the law of the Quran. But if you do not find any direction in the Quran, asked the Prophet, then I'll act according to the sunnah of the Prophet, the traditions of his behavior and sayings. That was his reply. But if you don't find any direction in the sunnah, he was asked again, then I'll exercise my judgment and act on that, came the reply. And that is the procedure that prevails among the majority of Muslims. The behavior or practice of Muhammad comes after the Quran, and then there's a consensus of opinion, and finally, there's an analogy from the principles of the Quran applied by right use of reason. And this is what characterizes the Sunni branch of Islam, and that is the majority party. We'll come to the Shiites later. But this is the majority, and this is what Sunni refers to. It refers to the people who accept these procedures in order. And it leads to the development of Sharia. This is the development of the code of laws. Sharia means the way. It's a code of laws for behavior, for leading a genuinely Muslim life. And there are several schools of thought that arise about interpreting the Quran and the Hadith and the Sharia. The Hanafite, I'll put these on the board for you so you can copy them down. The Hanafite allows the most liberal use of reason in interpreting these things. It's not bound by the strict literal sense of what is stated there. The Malachite is a branch of interpreting the law. It leans heavily on tradition, consensus. Let's see how people generally are taking, are understanding this rule or this passage of the Quran or this part of the Sharia and so on. And then the Shafi'ite see if I've got that. Yes. And this group gives equal weight to the hadith, the traditions, sometimes even more weight to the traditions than even the Quran. And finally, there's the Hanbalite. And this is the strictest, emphasizing the literal meaning of the Quran, and it's the founder of this school of thought was, in fact, however, arrested for denying that the Quran was eternal. And that's another issue that came up among them, is the Quran created or not? And it was in an issue that went back and forth for a while, and finally it was decided to say that the Quran was not created. The Quran has existed eternally in the mind of God, has ideas in his mind. Now, there are at least three senses in which something can be said to be created. The first is to mean that it has a beginning in time. There was a time when it didn't exist, and then it was created and began to exist. And that's clearly the one they're talking about. And so they want to say the Quran is uncreated. It didn't have a beginning in time. It always existed in the mind of God. But you could also distinguish two other senses. This is created one. Created two would mean is distinct from God. Creatures, created things are distinct. They're not God. They're a distinct reality. That's part of this, the general schema that we started with, right? With the divine and the non-divine world brought into being out of nothing. And then there's the third sense, and this is the most fundamental. That something depends on God. So, if something depends on God, it is, in that sense, created by God. It depends on his will that it exist. And so, it seems to me that, speaking of the Quran, you could argue it's uncreated in sense one, but created in sense three. And you might argue over its distinctness, but it's certainly a distinct thing. So it would be uncreated one, created two, created three. And that's not what happened in this controversy. The distinctions were not drawn. And the conclusion was finally reached that the Orthodox position is that the Quran is uncreated. And so the founder of this Hanbalite movement refused to deny the eternality of the Quran. And at that point, he was arrested. That was when things were swinging in the way of saying it is created. Later, it came back and exonerated him. I mean, the ultimate outcome of that controversy. Mutazilites said that the Quran was created and took a hard line on predestination and the literal meaning of the Quran, became champions of orthodoxy, held that the Quran's uncreated, and it's that its influence still lingers in the among Shiites. I said that we would not be treating these religions as a story of their history, which is why we have such an abbreviated introductions to them. But I didn't go into the history of Christianity and all the historic events and the denominations that have developed and so on. And I'm not trying to do history here either. Sticking with doctrine, with what's divine and how do people come to stand in proper relation to the divine. And that's why I'm now going through these doctrinal controversies. There were some very distinguished scholars produced that came out of Islam. Avicenna and Averroes, you'll read about them in your reading. And I'd like to spend a bit of time with Al-Ghazali. It's a favorite author of mine. And I'm going to read something that he wrote. Ghazali appeared on the scene when there was a great controversy over the Sufi movement. This is a movement of mystics within Islam, seeking unity with God. And some of it went to became pretty extreme and copied really Buddhism, as though they wanted to be absorbed into God or something like that. And that was rightfully, I think, regarded by the Orthodox Muslims as a heresy, as a false teaching. And so they became suspicious of all Sufism. Ghazali traveled all through the Muslim world and tried to make contact and understand all of the different viewpoints, and then wrote his great work, which was he titled The Revival of the Religious Sciences. Here's what he says about his own sojourn. Ever since I was 20, and I'm now over 50, I never ceased to investigate every dogma and belief. No Batonite did I come across without desiring to investigate his esotericism. No Zaharite without wishing to acquire the gist of his literalism. No philosopher without wanting to learn the essence of his philosophy. No theologian without striving to ascertain the object of his dialectics and theology. No Sufi without coveting to probe the secret of his Sufism. No ascetic without trying to delve into the origin of his asceticism. No atheist without groping for the causes of his bold atheism. And such was the unquenchable thirst of my soul for research and investigation from the early days of my youth, an instinct and temperament implanted in me by God through no choice of my own. And in this work, The Revival of the Religious Sciences, Al-Ghazali defends Sufism, not the extreme version where people say they're absorbed into God, but to experience a oneness with God. And in fact, Ghazali goes on to defend the position that the true belief rests on religious experience, experiencing God through reading the Quran, through Muslim practice, or maybe through being a mystic. And so that Sufism in its moderate form is to be accepted, the moderate form meaning that the worshipper doesn't become part of God, doesn't say there's really only God. There's creation too, but even as a creature, I may have a close union with God. The core of the religion, he holds, is can be even practiced by a non-Muslim. It's simply to repent of one's sins, purge the heart of all but God by exercises of religion, and attain a virtuous character. And that becomes then the core of Islam. And it's a marvelous thing to see this this work, and it came to prevail among the as theological orthodoxy in Islam. It's a remarkable achievement. Now, what I haven't... let me place Al-Ghazali in time for you. Let me make sure I get the spelling right here. Yeah. He died in 1111. That should be easy to remember. Now, what we haven't said anything about yet is the other major branch of Islam called the Shia branch, or the Shiites. And so that's a bit of a separate story, so I've kept it off here till the end and give it separate treatment. The Shiite branch of Islam dates from and is brought about by the question of who will succeed Muhammad upon his death. And the first couple of successors, by the way, the successor is called a caliph. Successor to head up the religion, and of course in the early days that made him commander of the armies as well. So after Muhammad died, a successor was chosen, and he died, and another successor was chosen. But when the third successor was about to be named, there was a controversy over whom it should be. And there was one party that backed a man named Ali, who was one of Muhammad's sons-in-law, and whose sons were the only male heirs, direct descendants of Muhammad. And there was a contender who wanted the caliphate, to be the next caliph, and there had lined up opposing armies. And the other contender proposed to Ali that they negotiate. So they held off the battle. And a great number of Ali's army left. They went AWOL because they were disgusted with him for not pursuing his rightful claim, they thought. And In the ensuing confusion, somebody assassinated this man. And the Shiites will not get over that. He was the rightful successor. That's the way the succession should have gone of the leadership for Islam. And the fact that it did not is still remembered every year. They have a celebration or a remembrance of Ali's assassination, includes a march through the streets whipping themselves so that blood comes down their backs and so on. It's a reminder of that he was wrongfully killed and deprived of the caliphate. Another term you need to know is imam, which simply means leader. And he was to be imam and caliph. The local clergyman in charge of a mosque is also today called an imam, and is regarded as the interpreter of Islam to that congregation. So the Shiite party splits from the Sunni party. They have a great emphasis on the last day and the judgment, and which time an imam called Mahdi is to appear just before the last judgment and gather his own people together. And they also took a position different from the Sunnis about free will, where the Sunni party generally emphasizes predestination, everything being foreordained by God, by Allah. The Sunnis affirm human free will, and they take the opposite position on the Quran. They take it that it is created by God. Now, again, they may be meaning created in the sense that, in the third sense, that it depends on God. I don't know. I'd have to ask a Shia and a Sunni about this sort of thing. But I think the three senses allow for it to be created in one sense and not in another. Created in the sense of depending on God, and uncreated in the sense maybe that God always had it in mind, if you want to put it that way. That's the way that the Sunni doctrine is phrased. These different sects, interpretations of the law and so on, still exist today. The two main branches of Islam are Shiite and Sunni. And the Sunni is the majority, and the Shiites the minority party. And I've tried to give you the overview of their relative positions, what they take on the doctrinal issues. There's a lot more to read about all of this. Of course, there's detail, and there are people involved and that I haven't named. They're in your reading. Again, I remind you, there's stuff in your reading I'm not covering. I'm covering stuff that's not in your reading. You put them together so as to get the whole picture that enables you to write the final exam. So this finishes our brief introduction, very brief introduction, to the three theistic religions. Of course, there are more religions in the world than just these. But these are the five big ones, so far as numbers of believers are concerned, or influence, influential thought, influential on one another. The number of practicing Jews in the world is not anywhere near the number of Muslims or Christians, and is less than the number of Buddhists or Hindus. But still, the Jewish thought is so important and so consequential for the others, not just for itself, but for the others, that it deserves to be included in the five. And of course, for no less reason than the fact that Christianity claims to be the right interpretation of Judaism. I mean, the New Testament even speaks of Gentiles now being grafted into the covenant of Israel through the work of Jesus Christ. And that's an understanding that comes out in the Apostle Paul, the book of Romans, and so on. The Christian church doesn't replace Israel. It becomes part of Israel. It's a transformed idea of what it is to be a Jew that makes a Christian an honorary Jew. The Muslims recognize that. I mentioned this once before. They recognize the commonality that we have, the Jews, Christians, and Muslims have, as in being people of the book. I like that expression. I think that people hold divinity beliefs, whatever they regard as divine, because it looks self-evidently right to them. There, these intuitions of self-evidency can't all be right because they yield contrary beliefs. But for the one who has the experience, it's enough to justify the belief. And that's where we're going to pick up. Next time we meet, we're going to evaluate these schemas, the relation, the pantheist relation of the divine to the non-divine, and the theist relation of the divine to the non-divine, and then the differences among the three theistic religions. But people hold these, as I started to say, because they're self-evident to them, but self-evidency is not infallible. And we know that because contrary conclusions appear self-evident to different people. Contrary beliefs, I should say, not conclusions. What I wanted to say is that these beliefs are not the conclusions of long arguments, logical proofs, that this world is Maya and Brahmanatman is the only reality, or logical proofs that God exists, or so on. That's not the way to go at it. And for the reason that from the pantheist perspective, logic is itself part of the world of Maya. It's part of the illusion. It doesn't get at the heart of reality. For the Hindu, logic works for the world of Maya, but not when you're reasoning about Brahmanatman, the divine. And for the Buddhist, logic doesn't even work for this reality. It's so chaotic. And that's what shows it to be unreal. For the theist, God has created everything visible or invisible, including the laws of logic. So it would be a big mistake to try to subject God to those laws and construct a proof of his existence that demotes him to being one more creature subject to those laws rather than the creator of those laws. So with this little anticipation of what's to come, we'll end our survey of these religions. And next time we'll talk about how to view these two different schemas, and we'll critiquing them and pointing out the problems raised by each, and drawing conclusions about whether those problems can, in terms of that tradition, be solved, be resolved. And it will not come as a surprise to you that I think that the difficulties with the pantheist schema, with the pantheist traditions, can't be resolved, and that the difficulties with Judaism and Islam are that they reject the idea of incarnation, increaturation, which is the only way we could know anything about God. And they make use of that knowledge while denying the increaturation or incarnation. And I'm going to point out how that all shakes out when we meet again next time.